ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So the conclusion of one of the elements of yesterday's discussion, you have this in the theme here of purity. Then if one is pure, one is enthusiastic to hear the holy name. So here we see is that this is the element of Vedic training that you don't get in other systems generally like that, is that it's a combination of the interest and proper behavior of the hearer and the application of what is being heard. Does this make sense? It means Krishna says in the Gita that that this knowledge is gained through pranipata, pariprashna, and seva. Right? This is the method. Is that when there is submissive inquiry, then, means if there's interest, there's submissive inquiry. And if there's submissive inquiry, then, then that will be applied through service. Right? But now this service means it's with the understanding from what you've heard. In other words, the theory and the process, practical, is combined. Well, that's important, because if you only theorize, then we see that these persons also don't become purified or interested. And people who only practice but don't use the theory, then they get caught up in the ritual. Right, so one gets caught up by karma, one gets caught up by jnana. Right, but if the karma and jnana are combined, then that gives you the proper understanding. That gives you the enthusiasm. That generates more interest to know. Does that make sense? And so then again, the living entity will inquire. Does that make sense? So it's a cycle. Very important, because we're thinking, well, practically how to gain this, because it says by being pure. So we're pointing out that the purity is there as part of devotional service. It doesn't stand on its own. Right? So the practical point that makes it work is the service. That's why we see the brahmachari, he's dedicated to service. I mean, to knowledge, to study. So a major part of their activity is menial service and the practice of what they learn. Does that make sense? That generates interest to know. Does that make sense? So it goes together. If one has the interest to know, one will, means, how you say, then one will want to apply it. And if one applies it, then there is the desire to know. Now, one engenders the other. So now the problem is, well, how do you start it? How do you get it working? Right? So that's through sadhu sangha. Right? So by the association of devotees, one becomes inspired. Then one wants to hear from them. One wants to apply. And then the more one does that, the more one wants to do it. Right? That's how karma works. This is not karma, but we're saying this is how the action and reaction of things work. You do an activity, then after having done it, you will get the result of it. But at the same time as having done the activity, the desire to do that activity again is created. Right? Does that make sense? That's what the seed is. Right? You have the bija, you have the kutaj, then you have the prarabdha? What's before? Phulan mukhi, and then prarabdha. So what's happening is that a seed is there, you act on the seed, activity is therefore performed, the seed sprouts. That sprout turns into the tree or the full situation in which your reaction will be received, right? Because you don't just get it out of nowhere. You're not just in space and suddenly, you know, whatever you deserve shows up. No, you're in an environment where it's perfect. You know, you are on the 8-lane highway and you've just dropped something out of the car and you just get out of the car to get it and you just get run over by the Mack truck. So it would be really hard for the Mack truck to run you over in your living room. I mean, it does happen. You know, we see Arnold G. is very good at this. But other than that, then it's difficult. So therefore, you have to be in the situation where the result will be received, right? So that's Phulan Mukhi. Then the result itself is Prarabdha, right? But now when you perform this activity, so that starts, because this line makes great sense. You know, it's just natural. The seed, it sprouts, it grows, it gives fruit. But now when you act on that seed creates another one. Does that make sense? You do something, and having done it, the desire to do it again is created. You may not feel it then or act on it, but when the situation arises, that comes. That's why it's probably, I mean, Rupa Goswami is pointing out that unless you're purified by devotional service, you can't get rid of those seeds. Because other people purify themselves and they deal with all these Prarabdha karma. That's okay, that's nice, they become more pure, more pious, but the problem is all the desire seeds that have been created by the original activity remain. So if the situation arises, again they may do something, right? Does that make sense? That's why you see nice people do things that they shouldn't, right? Because they may have purified themselves, but still those things are left over. But if they stick to the devotional process, they'll go away. Right? Does that make sense? So that, yes.
So you're talking puja? You're talking proclivity to do it again?
Yeah. Basically the sprout, some of these things have these double meanings when they're explained, because you're dealing with poetry, you know, much to the chagrin of Plato G. But in it they'll do two things at once, like you see in the 11th canto when they're describing deity worship. Then they'll say, they'll just be describing the process of purification, of taking a bath and using mud. At the same time, it describes the purification with water and putting tilak. As you can see by the words listed, it overlaps because the process is the same. So many times they'll do these kind of things. The kutaj is the sprout. That's how it probably describes it. But in that, it also creates the next one. Just like in logic, you make your statement. Then to explain your statement, the statement itself doesn't generally arise doubt. It's too short. It's too specific. But when I explain my thesis, that creates the doubt. Right? So it's natural that when the thing sprouts, that's the time when the next thing is created. Does that make sense? Like that. So basically is that when you see different words used or different perspectives, this is called vichar. In other words, studying something from many different angles, because otherwise we tend to, means the idea is we want to simplify, you know, and get things to be practical. In doing that, we'll do that with whatever knowledge we have. But now if ego is there, we'll stop at that point. But by vichar, we continue studying it from different angles, and you actually see that the perspective is much broader than, or much more detailed or deep than we had originally thought. Which is not a problem, because you have to get a grasp on it, and then from there you add, right? You're not going to go from 0 to 100 without some few seconds in between, right? Does that make sense? There'll be something. So it's not a problem. Whatever information you have, but one should be always trying to see more. That's why you see in the scriptures they'll describe the same thing from different angles. Like on the logic we described here, if we're just presenting the point, It's very simple. It has one group of terminology. It means you make the theory, you give its explanation, you give examples, then you conclude those examples, and then you sum the whole thing up. Very simple, straightforward, but there's nobody arguing the point there. Right? But in describing these things, you have the element of doubt coming up. All right, doubt, misgiving. Good morning, sir. And so then there's another way it's described, the exact same thing, that you have the thesis, that's the same, then you have the doubt rather than the explanation, right? Then the doubt then has its examples and everything like that, right? But in the process of you giving your examples, you clear the doubt. And in clearing the doubt, you synthesize it, right? It means what you're making, saying, and what they're saying is not different. Right, you bring out the thing, then you synthesize it, then you come to your conclusion. So some will say one system is Vyasa, one system is Gotama. It's the same system. Right? It's the same system, just two different angles. It means your presentation is simply going to be make your point as concisely and clearly as possible so people know what you're talking about. Right? Then every word after that has meaning, otherwise they don't know what you're talking about. Right? Next, you fill it out so that it's more clear. Then you start giving your examples. But when you're filling it out, that will arise the doubts. So when you give your examples, they should establish what you say and clear any doubts that people may say. Like you see, Prabhupada uses in the purport so many times, some may say, or it is said. These are, in other words, he's come to this third part where the second part he's raising the doubt, and then the third, the example, he'll clear it. Right? Does that make sense? Then, after that, then he'll show that there's no problem here. There isn't an argument. And then he'll restate the thesis, but now a little bit more filled out, more practical. You know, how you're going to actually see it, you perceive it. Does that make sense? The first one is just straight theory. The last one will be that theory with the actual view of it, the vision of it. Does that make sense? So it's not different. So when you go through the scripture, you will see that different acharyas use different words. And it seems different, but it's not. It's just a different angle on the same thing. Does that make sense? So just to sum that up so we can get back to the philosophical points, it means these Western philosophical points, is that by the association of devotees, then we get that inspiration to take up the devotional process. In doing that, that inspires us to hear. By hearing in the proper association, the proper attitude, then we want to apply it. When we apply it, that will engender more wanting to hear. Does that make sense? So this is the cycle that is being described. So that's why you would see Prabhupada put so much emphasis on service. Because it's the service that digests. It's like someone gave example yesterday, that it's like you eat. And I've just eaten a full meal. So it's just like I've heard so much knowledge. Now can I eat again immediately? No. And if I just sit there, it's going to take longer. Right? Or I might get sick. But if I go out and do some work, right, some physical activity, then it digests. Then I can eat more. Does that make sense? So when you use the intelligence and practical application, then the heart is able to accommodate more understanding about Krishna or more hearing about Krishna. Because in the process of serving, you reduce the material obstacles. So that means you free space in the heart, and then which you can now fill with Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? So that's why in the Vedic view, service is always part of the educational process. Right? Either directly or indirectly. It means it's like you're just coming here, but you have to do some service sometime in the day. You know what I'm saying? The study is not your service. It's the knowledge part of the service. Then you have to contemplate and practically apply. Just like the brahmachari sits in a classroom, but he also does other menial service. He goes begging, he cleans, he takes care of the cows, he does so many things. The two go together, right? Shravana, you hear. Manana, you contemplate and practice. Then, nididhyasana, you get realization. Right? The realization means you want to hear more. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah? So this is what we're looking at. So this chapter here is bringing this out very much, of these connecting these two, the purity and the and the hearing of the service. Okay. Say again? Nididhyasana. Yeah, these are Upanishadic terms. Like that. Shravana means you hear. Manana means you practice and contemplate. So you see is that you also have this splits education into learning by rote, or, you know, trying to inspire. Do you put it in or do you draw it out? Right? It has to be one or the other, right? Is it day or is it night? There's no such thing as twilight in modern, you know. So the whole point is, and you can't bring out unless something's been put in, right? I put money in the bank, I can draw it out. I put no money in the bank, I can't draw it out. So the Vedic is first you put in, then you draw out, because you have something to draw out. And then they practice it, that will give understanding of it. Then by continual, that habit, then will create realization. But if I don't combine knowledge and practice, I won't get realization. You know what I'm saying? Just like you see, there's that very nice devotee who always is doing service, nice, always there, ready to do anything, but isn't really that, doesn't really like to get into the philosophy or class, just practical. Then someday they have problem, and everyone wonders why. They were just, because they didn't contemplate. They didn't connect what they were hearing with the service. They were just very nice people, very pious, so they took to the karma yoga aspect of the process very naturally. But because they didn't add into it the point of contemplation, you know, according to their ability, then we see they may have problems. Or you have the person who's very good in the philosophy, knows everything, but doesn't really get involved much in the service. They have problems. Right? Yeah. Well, it's samvit will be the combination. That's manana. When samvit is combined with haladini, then sandini will give the realization. The realization actually comes from sandini, because that means coming from Krishna. He is existence. Right? So when sambandha, you hear, in other words, you hear all the different aspects like that, that should engender the desire to know, right? So that will be the prajumna. Then Vasudeva will be applied in manana. Then you'll get the result, the prayojana of of realization. But interestingly enough, it's given by sandini. It's given by the sandini potency. That's why everything always goes back. So it's always a circle. Okay. Is that okay? Yeah. Okay, so mm-hmm. We left off at.
Yeah, we are going to begin. Mundus sensibilis. So this is at the bottom in my study guide. I don't know what yours.
It's at the bottom.
Page 15. Last paragraph. So we yesterday spoke of the, you know, the classical intellectual. Now we're going to speak about, as the sentence begins, other people scoff at the intellectual. There are people who think to be an intellectual or philosopher is just to float castles in the sky. They're no better than impractical dream chasers. Now we are speaking of the philosophers known as the pragmatists. And I think it's important that you know that the United States of America is the birthplace of pragmatism, and pragmatism is still the reigning philosophy there. In fact, I have a book in my collection with a quite ironic title, written by an American scholar, and it's entitled Pragmatism, the American Avoidance of Philosophy. Because pragmatism actually doesn't come to grips with what is traditionally known as the philosophical issues. So we just keep reading and you'll see it. They, meaning the pragmatists, they are convinced we live in a mundus sensibilis. That's the practical world. Since the only things in it that we can call real are what our senses can perceive, and more importantly, what they can seize. You see, just like for a real pragmatist, you know, okay, I can see with my senses there are clouds in the sky. All right, so they have some reality, but they're useless to me. I can't go up there and grab them and bring them down, put them to work in my garden, you know. Mm-hmm. Have my own clouds.
Rain.
Yeah. On, off switch. You know, rain. Stop rain. So therefore, you know, a pragmatist is not only the opposite of a traditional philosopher intellectual, he too is not very, doesn't have a poetic type of imagination. It's just what he can get his hands on and work with. So, yes, the practical world is not all that complicated. You know, when you get right down to, in other words, this is the animal world, you see. Animal life is not that complicated. It's eating, sleeping, mating, defending, you know. And besides, scientists, who are kind of like the brahmanas of the pragmatists, they're making things easier for us by the minute. The day will come, sooner or later, when there'll be nothing left for us to do except have a good time. A party without end. Maybe even on other worlds, as well as planet Earth. You see, we'll be able to fly to other planets and rockets and set up our, you know the whole scenario, set up our extraplanetary condominiums with our television sets and our robot servant. Yeah. I remember when I grew up in the 1950s, there were so many science fiction movies envisioning the future like that. Mm-hmm. You see, human beings on some other planet just sitting around, pressing buttons, everything happening for them. You see, this is the ultimate dream of pragmatism. So, on the next page, well, I say, well, as it turns out, even a world-famous scientist like Albert Einstein had serious doubts about what is really going on when our senses connect with their objects. In his book, The World as I See It, which was published in 1934, he plainly suggested sense perception and the type of reasoning that grows from sense perception may have no meaning whatsoever. And this is a quotation. To inquire after the meaning or object of one's own existence, or of creation generally, has always seemed to me absurd from an objective point of view. And yet, objective point of view, again, it means practically speaking. That's, you have objective, these are two philosophical terms. Objective means what's out there. You know, that we all can see, like this pair of cartels, we would say it's an objective fact. Does anyone see me holding a bunch of flowers here? If you do, I can advise a few places in Calcutta where you can visit. Well, examine your workings of your mind very carefully.
Peanut butter cookie.
But I think if we can all agree that I have cartels in my hand, then we call that an objective fact, because, you see, we all see it. And then there's subjectivity. This is internal. So this is where we may disagree, you see. That's I have my idea about something. My that came out of yesterday's lunch, or the day before yesterday, lunch function. We won't mention the other party. So that was a demonstration of different subjective ways of viewing things. So that's also there. That's also part of, certainly very, very much a part of human philosophical or intellectual life. So Albert Einstein is saying, to inquire after the meaning or object of one's own existence or of the creation in general has always seemed to me to be absurd from an objective point of view. Because as Prabhupada said, Albert Einstein was actually some kind of theist. He did have a belief in God. He used to speak of God. And so, therefore, what he's saying here is that God's creation, it's rather absurd to think that a human being will ever be able to grasp the whole thing, get his hands on the whole thing. There are always going to be questions that remain to be investigated. And he goes on to say, and yet mankind has certain ideals. So ideal, that again means the subjective, you see. There are ideas, ideals, questions that push us from within, which determine the direction of his endeavors and his judgments. In this sense, I have never looked upon ease and happiness as ends in themselves. In other words, you see, what he's saying here is, what's behind science is this subjective need of the human being to know what's really happening in the world. This is what is pushing. In the Bhagavatam also, Maharaj Pariksit is being pushed to ask questions. By what? By his ideals. He has his ideals, of course, the perfect ideals. He's a devotee, pure devotee of the Lord since even before his birth. And he's been raised in most proper culture of a Kshatriya. So he's being pushed by those ideals to inquire from Srila Shukadeva Goswami. So that is also, you see, science, the word science, it's justifiably a pejorative term in our movement. Pejorative means that we don't, following Srila Prabhupada, we don't think that highly of material scientists. But the word science comes from Greek skios, which means simply to know. So sometimes Prabhupada would use the word science in a positive way. He would say that Krishna consciousness is not a religion, it is a science, but it's a spiritual science. So it's not a science that you go into some laboratory to work with. The laboratory is your own consciousness, you see. That's the laboratory of the science of Krishna consciousness. That there are these activities of bhakti yoga, and we find ourselves as we're starting it that our consciousness is very much afflicted by the modes of rajagun, tamagun. But as we begin the great experiment of chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra and following the Four Vedic principles, we find in the laboratory of our consciousness that the lower modes are dropping away, we're becoming purified, we're coming to the mode of goodness. And the process is becoming easier and easier because we're in the mode of goodness and then even coming to Vasudeva, the transcendental goodness. So Einstein concluded, in this sense, in other words, in the sense of the ideals that push us to know what is really happening, I have never looked upon ease and happiness as ends in themselves. Such an ethical basis I call more proper for a herd of swine. In other words, a herd of pigs. if all of our, you know, brainy modern intellectualism, the practical goal of it is simply to become what they call a couch potato. You know, sitting in a couch, gradually developing the shape of a potato, you know, round and soft, and you have your television, what is it called anyway?
Remote
control, and you're just sitting there switching. You've got your satellite on satellite receiver, so 500 channels from around the world, and you're just switching between these channels until you find something that holds your interest for 5 seconds or 10 seconds. That's about the attention span of people today. As I've seen, I've practically seen this sometimes waiting in airports to catch a flight, and they'll have, in the more modern ones, TV monitors installed in the ceiling, and there's no sound. You just see what, and the images just keep changing. It's this MTV, musical television. So it's really absurd, you know, because they keep the sound system in the airport clear, because they're constantly having to make announcements. I think you can get a microphone and some jack in your chair if you want to hear it. But if you're just sitting there waiting to hear your flight being announced, so you just see this TV, and it's just every 2-3 seconds, it's just something different, you know. It's just, you're on, the musicians are on top of a mountain, and then they're in the middle of a city, and then they're in outer space, and then, you know, it just keeps changing. It's because people's attention span is so short. It means they have no intelligence. Intelligence is that faculty. The mind by itself, yes, the mind without an intellectual background will just chase after the images of the five senses, willy-nilly, you know. That's the mind of lower creatures. Like, watch birds, you see. They're always... because they're looking, you know, they're probably said the general state of animal consciousness is one of fear. They're always afraid that they're going to... bird especially. We were talking about, was it yesterday, the cat that trained the bird?
Yeah.
So the bird became a double agent. It's called a double agent. It's on the side of the cat. So that's why birds, they have to keep a sharp eye out. Because they have these clever cats chasing them. But this is animal consciousness, you see, always looking for danger. And buddhi intelligence means to be able to fix the mind. In fact, there's a North Indian saying that the fall down of animals is when their minds become fixed. Because as animals, they have to look out for danger. You know, if an animal becomes too absorbed, say a bird becomes too absorbed in eating something, and all of its other perceptions except just the tongue shut down, then he's in real danger, because any cat or anything can come creeping up and he won't notice it. But this North Indian saying goes on to say the fall down of a human being is when his mind, just as Krishna uses the same term, is many branched, is, you know, everywhere at once. So it's human dharma, manusha dharma, to learn to fix up the mind, become ekayana. But that means to become fixed up on Krishna, not on Betty Boop. On Krishna, you see. That's yoga. So Einstein, one of the greatest scientists in the last several hundred years, he says that to use science to come to an end of ease and sensual happiness, that's ethically no better than pig life. And that's why Prabhupada liked Einstein. You find often Prabhupada praising Albert Einstein. He was a theist. He believed in God, you see. And he made such statements like this in Prabhupada. We've heard many, many statements like this from His Divine Grace. So, in other words, Einstein didn't consider mankind's proclivity to figure out the purpose of his life on Earth, or for that matter, the purpose of Earth's place in the universe, to be all that reasonable, you see. To figure it out ourselves with our little human brain. It's not that reasonable. But still, we have ideals, inner ideals, that push us to understand. So we can't give it up. Therefore, scientists, you know, science, even though they've done so many terrible things. I mean, isn't it? You know, if science was a person, if you took all science together and personified it as one person, he'd be in prison. He'd be under a life sentence right now for all the things that he's done. You know. So, going on. Similarly, Einstein's contemporary Sigmund Freud considered those who make such inquiries to be mentally ill. I probably didn't like Sigmund Freud very much. Not at all. He said he was one of the three great demons of the recent time, along with Marx and Darwin. So you see, Einstein, understanding the limitations of the human being, didn't consider the attempt to objectively, again, as easy as picking up a pair of cartels, I can hold the whole universe in my hand. Hiranyakashipu tried for that. But objectively speaking, that's not very sensible. The Prabhupada gives this example in Chaitanya Charitamrita. To try to understand the Lord and His creation with this human brain is like to try to keep an elephant on a saucer. You see? Hello? Yeah. There's teacup and there's saucer, you know? So, try to carry around an elephant on a tea saucer. That again qualifies you for the padded room.
They make nice Bugle Bundys.
Huh?
They make nice Bugle Bundys.
Yeah, right, they do. Those Vrindavan jackets. You know. So there are rooms that are padded in the same way for persons who think that they can hold elephants on teacups. And, you know, they keep their arm here because they think they're Napoleon or whatever. To continue. So Freud said to make these inquiries is to be crazy, because he was an atheist. He said there's no point at all. But Einstein acknowledged that the human being, or the human nature, is ideal driven. It's a state of nature that he was prepared to accept. Sigmund Freud wasn't, being an atheist. Because actually that's the ultimate ideal, God. God is the ultimate. Ideal means perfectional state. So God, Krishna, is the ideal personality. Prabhupada uses the word ideal in exactly that way, in many places in his purports. But Sigmund Freud was a materialist, a gross materialist, a very sinister, demoniac. I mean, I've read some of the things. I've got a book with the very ironic title, Great Thoughts, you know, the great thoughts of history. It's got a lot in there from people like Sigmund Freud, and you realize as soon as you start reading, these thoughts are not so great. They're quite the opposite. So he was a real demon. So Einstein accepted that human nature is idealistic, so there has to be, there will be the endeavor to understand the truth. And so therefore Einstein himself was a scientist, but he was not a laboratory scientist. He was not a physical scientist in the sense of relying on his own senses. Actually, he was a mathematician. His theory of relativity he worked out by mathematics. And Prabhupada, in explaining, Maharaj was speaking earlier about different types of logic. So Srila Prabhupada, speaking in Western terms, he said, we, as devotees, we follow deductive logic. And he compared that to mathematics. It's something that you just can't argue with. Of course, there's people who do argue that 2 and 2 is not 4, and they give all kinds of wild types of. There's in fact a kind of logic called Polish logic. I'm not being facetious. It's a serious form of modern logic called Polish logic, where, you know, 2 and 2 can be 108 or, you know, whatever. How they arrive at those conclusions, I don't understand. But anyway, But, you know, objectively, basically, sanely, 2 plus 2 is 4, you see. So, that's deductive logic, you see. It's unarguable. So Prabhupada said we are also, that's the type of logic we in Krishna consciousness use. In other words, there are some unarguable first principles. That's what mathematics is. That there, for example, numbers. If you're not prepared to accept that there are numbers, you know, that numbers are just figment of human imagination and they don't really exist, then what's mathematics going to be to you? It's just going to be a kind of black magic or something, you know, a kind of fabulous... I hear someone's cell phone. you know, one won't be able to enter mathematics if he doesn't accept numbers and their numerical values and their relationships, how they work together in addition, subtraction, a multiplication, division, and there's algebra. Algebra means you make a formula, a numerical formula. It's like a little machine, actually. It's a machine made of numbers, you know. It's quite a far-out concept. And then it just works. You know, you apply it, you get to different problems, and you get an answer from the working on the machine. It's actually a mental computer. Now we're going to... We may get to that, actually. And algebraic logic originates in India. It's called algebra because that's an Arabic term, but where did the Arabs get their mathematics from? From India. They came to India and they discovered all this. At one time, you know, we have to give credit where credit is due. The Arabic or Mohammedan Islamic civilization outside of India was the most advanced civilization. They were much more advanced than the European Christians in the middle of, in the dark, what's called the Dark Ages. In those days, the Christians were into, you know, there was only one book to read, the Bible. There was only, you know, it was very, very narrow-minded. And actually, the Christians discovered philosophy, Greek philosophy, Plato, Aristotle, from the Arabs, because they had translated, they had gotten manuscripts and translated into Arabic. And universities were established in Europe, the first universities. I think the first one was Sorbonne in Paris, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I think that was the first one in the Middle Ages. And then Oxford was pretty early. The Germans had universities pretty early. And their main business was to translate from Arabic into their own languages Greek and Roman writings. Because they, although they were Europeans, they didn't have the originals. They had to get them from the Arabs because they were so behind things. So anyway, so to use this type of knowledge, vidya, in the sense of education, like here at this school, mathematics is taught, language is taught. This is all vidya, but if the aim of that is sloth, laziness, actually that's one of the in Christianity, one of the seven deadly sins, personified as the demon goddess Belphegor. I don't like that. No worse train of thought breaker than a cell phone.
Definitely, everybody knows them in class, but somehow there's certain
They think that's the best time to call because you're sitting in one place.
I've
noticed that. You know, I've noticed that in temples too. The most frequent time for phone calls is during the Bhagavatam class because they know the devotee they want to talk to will be there.
Will be there.
You know, so. And they think that what they have to say is more important than what's being said in the class. So Yeah, Beltagor. That's an ancient Chaldean goddess of the type of sloth that results from knowledge. You know, the type of lazy intellectual. He's very smart, but that intelligence translates into easygoing life. Liberalism, you know, that, like the modern intellectuals, they're the leading liberals, you know. Well, it doesn't matter what you do. Because they're atheists, they're, you know, scientists, so there's no God, there's no law of karma, there's no, you know. So you can do anything you want to do, fine, it's cool. And just enjoy yourself, basically. Don't work too hard. You see. So this is what, in ancient times, it was the demoniac goddess Belpagor. She's sort of like the, like in India, you have Lakshmi, Alakshmi. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like, I've never heard of a goddess Asaraswati, but. Well, I guess, yeah, there is Tamasi. There's a goddess Tamasi mentioned in the Lakshmi Tantra. And that is Kali, actually. So she's the personification.
The goddess Kali. It's amazing because the Bengalis are kind of like the intellectuals of India, and that's their deity.
Yeah, one of them. Okay. Along with Kerala, the sites of the Communist Party, you know, where the Communist Party is ruling. The Communist Party is, you know, dead and gone everywhere else except weird places like Cuba and North Korea. And the Bengalis are still there. Last time I was there, I saw them marching in the streets.
No, they say the Russians didn't stick
Russians
it out.
Are still secretly communist.
No, they're not communists. They gave up the faith. They didn't persevere.
Yeah.
You know?
And now, yeah, I've actually heard Bengalis tell me that Lenin and Stalin were actually really Bengalis. They went to Russia. I've actually heard that. They betrayed the two Mahaprabhus went there.
Oh, these guys are nuts.
Right. Oh, that's why. That's
what maybe is it also a connection? Because I was going on the train to Calcutta, and there was all these guys going in for a communist rally. And I said, "What's your ultimate, you know, goal that you're trying to get by all this striking and you know all this stuff?" He said, "Full pay, no work."
Communist ideal. True.
Yeah.
So, to continue, however, the pursuit of a, quote, ideal, unquote, materially easy-going life, supported by scientific advancements in the field of sense gratification, Albert Einstein condemned as being an ethical rationale suitable for a herd of pigs. So now we move on. I think that point is clear enough.
But one question just comes up, it's just a question in here, because it seems to go back and forth where you get the idea to inquire after the meaning or object of one's own existence or creation generally has seemed to me absurd.
From an objective point of view.
Okay, but subjective, he says it's correct.
Yeah, because he goes on to say, and yet mankind has certain ideals which determine the direction of his endeavors.
Okay, so
the ideals are subjective, coming from insight.
Okay, so objective means just what is perceivable by the senses.
Right, that's okay. That's okay. Generally what it means in the Western world.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
So to continue, some lofty thinkers. So, oh yeah. Well, we have to talk about the viewhats here, and this is interesting because sense perception. Well, the mind is the same. You couldn't perceive anything without the mind. And the mind is called the center of the senses, or the sixth sense. So that is actually aniruddha. But then how is it that it's the lowest, simultaneously the lowest type of knowledge? And that's explained in the Bhagavatam, that within this universe, you see, there's an ananta outside the universe, but there's an ananta inside the universe, and he is associated with aniruddha. And in fact, sometimes they're indistinguishable. But there's actually one verse, I believe, in the fifth or sixth canto, I've forgotten now which canto, but fifth or sixth, in which it is said that Aniruddha and Sankarshan are both names of the same personality of Godhead. So along with the mind comes the false ego, you see,
yeah,
at least in the material world.
The values are based on a false identity.
So therefore they're inseparable. And that's what I was talking about before. The mind itself is in the mode of material goodness. But if one only stays in the mode of material goodness, then the mode of ignorance in the form of pride is going to come up. You see, inevitably, it has to. That's the way it works. And that is actually the way things are arranged by these Vyuha avatars themselves.
Well, because the one has to get back to the other.
Yeah.
We were just going through Pranipata, Pari Prashna Sevya. From the Sevya, go back.
Right.
From, go. So when you get to Aniruddha, it's going back to Sankarshan.
Yeah. And that's... Yes, Sankarshan, interestingly, we were talking the other day about him. So as Mahavishnu, he's in Yoga Nidra. The Jivas are in Tamoguna sleep. But they're also associated with Sankarshana, great saints and sages, like Lord Shiva in Kailash, for example. He's a worshipper of the same Sankarshana. And we know Narada Muni and four Kumaras, they go to talk with Lord Sankarshan. That's because he is actually, in Yoga Nidra, he's not asleep in the sense of, you know, conked out in the mode of ignorance. He's in a state of consciousness called pragya, which means that knowledge which is actually not subject to the senses or even the emotional mind. It is the fixed consciousness fixed in yoga. This is called pragya, and Krishna talks about pragya in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. He said, when you become master of your senses and your mind, then you attain pragya. So, in Brahmaloka, Janaloka, Tapaloka, these Prabhupada once called them the Muni Lokas, where the great sages live. That's where the rishis reside. That is a prevailing state of consciousness, is pragya. Their minds are fixed in yoga, and therefore the attractions of the, you know, the emotions of the mind and the sensual attractions of the senses do not sway them from that. They're not interested in that. And in the what's known as the Deva Yuga, the first day of Brahma, all of creation was on that level. But because so many living entities are within Garbhodakashaya Vishnu, and he can feel them wanting to come out, so therefore Brahma has to do his visarga from the position of that state of pragya, fixity of mind in yoga. He has to perform what's called visarga, the secondary creation, in which room is made within the virat rupa for those in rajaguna and tamoguna. And we're in the rajasic region. The human being, it says in the Bhagavatam, that our svabhava, our nature, is rajasic. See? Which brings up another point, talking about levels of consciousness. You see, there is Sushupti, Svapna, Jagrata, and Turiya. These also correspond to the four Vyuhas. So, Turiya means the fourth state above the modes of material nature. That is Vasudeva Sattva. Jagrata, wakefulness, that is Aniruddha. That means the mind is awake and receiving sense impressions and guiding, you know, by its desire, ordering the senses what it wants done. Then svapna means dream. So the jagrata is in the mode of goodness, actually. Mode of goodness in the sense that everything is working, you see. Everything is functioning. So if everything, you know, the question is whether everything's functioning properly or not. So if everything's functioning properly, then you have Varna Ashram Dharma, which Prabhupada said is a social system which is situated in the mode of goodness, even though there are Shudras and there are Vaishyas and there are Kshatriyas within it. The whole system is in the mode of goodness, you see. So therefore everyone in it, they, you know, you may start off as a Shudra, but by being in it you will become promoted to the mode of goodness. Maharaj agrees, he is the master of Manusamhita, so I'm always looking for confirmation. It's interesting, human beings' nature is generally rajasic. So that is not jagrat, that's svapna. So the ordinary state of consciousness of human being, because Bhagavatam explains in the 11th canto, which, again, remembering that lunch we had the other day, one exalted god brother said, "I had nothing to do with that canto." So I was quoting 11th canto, and he wasn't accepting anything from it. So anyway, if you can accept the 11th canto, then it says that the chit potency, pure consciousness in this material world, is pervaded by the four states. You see, Turiya is certainly there because that is the aspect of chit shakti. It is transcendental. But it is also pervaded by Jagrata, Svapna, and Sushupti simultaneously. Therefore, Jung, for example, the great psychiatrist or psychoanalyst, he used to talk about the unconscious as being always with us, even when we're so-called awake. We do things unconsciously, you see, like automatically. Or sometimes, for example, we forget things. You know, the consciousness becomes covered. For me, it's the most frustrating thing. You know, I know this thing, like a Sanskrit word, you know, a Sanskrit term, a philosophical term. I know it. You know, you say it's right on the tip of your tongue, but you just can't get it out. You know, something's blocking it. So that's actually the unconscious or the Sushupti factor. It just steps in, and you just can't get it. You see. So all these things are simultaneously running at once, and just according to the day, the time. Vagish was talking about how the evening is when you were saying Varuna covers the world. Yeah. So Varuna covers the world with ignorance, so that we can go to sleep. We can sleep at night. You see, you notice in the evening you feel tired, you start to yawn, and you want to take rest. That's the influence of Varuna Dev. It said that Varuna, he covers the world with sleep, but then he sends forth his spies. Therefore, there's an old poetic phrase. It reoccurs. I read a lot, so I know these kind of things. There's an old poetic phrase which reoccurs throughout history. And in fact, in the 1940s, they even made a movie with this phrase as the title, "The Night Has a Thousand Eyes." And that refers to Varuna's spies. His eyes are everywhere. So sinful activities are committed at night. And there's actually in the Vedas, it's a very remarkable passage. It says, when two people meet at night to conspire together, a third one is there. And that means Varuna or Varuna's spy. You see, and it describes all kinds of sinful activities performed under darkness. You know, two people or three people, you know, whatever. They get together to do something sinful. But the Rig Vedic passage going, and yet there is another who is observing. Of course, ultimately that is Paramatma Supersoul. But one is judged by Yamaraj. Yamaraj is like that with Varuna. They're both neighbors. So it means Varuna's. They're like, you know, Varuna, it's like the FBI, you know, and Yamaraj, the Justice Department in America. So then witnesses are called in, you know, the undercover agents. They're called in to testify. Yes, on the night of January 25th, I heard this person say this, or I saw this person do this. You know, that's the testimony that's read against. And that's Varuna's agents. So they appear as on the witness stand. So I think we have to stop now because we go into extramundus, and that's very interesting, and there's a lot to talk about there. So thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.
Jai.
Shri Bhagavatam ki jai.